It turns out the industrial spills and accidents which have polluted the Ohio River over the years have actually steered more dollars into water safety.
Because you have to justify the expense, and there's so many things that need to be paid for to make people's lives safer and better.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, sometimes there's a silver lining in environmental disasters. Plus, a veteran travels to North Dakota to support the Standing Rock Sioux. They're trying to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from tunneling under a lake near tribal lands.
They're saying this water goes out into so many different communities, and we're standing up for them as well.
And a little birdie told me these guys are already roosting, maybe in a neighborhood near you. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. New documents have emerged that show the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency downplayed the risks of fracking in a landmark report. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
The EPA's report was supposed to settle the question once and for all on whether or not fracking for oil and gas damages water supplies, using science, not politics. In Pennsylvania, there were already more than 250 documented cases in which fracking damaged private drinking water supplies. But when the EPA's draft report was issued in June of 2015, the headline reported fracking did not cause, quote, widespread systemic impacts on drinking water. This was cheered by industry and spurned by environmentalists. The science in the report, however, told a different story. The EPA's own science advisory board then issued a critical review of the EPA's headline, saying it confused the public and needed clarification. Michael Halperin with the Union of Concerned Scientists sought documents from the EPA through a right to know request. What Halperin discovered were last-minute changes made to the headline. Instead of highlighting the risks, they were downplayed. Halperin worries about scientific integrity at the EPA under a Trump administration.
Given the names that are circulating for key positions in the Trump administration, who are oil and gas industry insiders and lobbyists, I'm very concerned that science that is critical to protecting public health and safety will be more vulnerable to spin and suppression.
The Obama administration pinned its climate change fight on the Clean Power Plan, which depended heavily on the use of natural gas as a bridge fuel to renewables. That plan, however, is in jeopardy. President-elect Trump has said he plans to scrap it and encourage fossil fuel use. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
That story was first published by the public radio show Marketplace. Industry has left a dirty legacy along the Ohio River. We're talking about toxins like PCBs, dioxins, and mercury, discharged into the water by steel mills and the petroleum industry for decades. For our Headwater series, Exploring the Future of the Ohio River, Judy Peterson says these legacy pollutants are still a problem. Peterson's the executive director of the Kentucky Waterways Alliance.
What happens with those kind of pollutants is they accumulate in the sediment. All the little insects and the bugs that form the base of the food chain in the river, they get contaminated. Small fishes eat those and bigger fishes eat them. And when it moves up through the food chain, that's called bioaccumulation. The worst problems are people that would eat a lot of fish out of the Ohio. And I believe that there are disadvantaged people in many of these communities, like they are on the West End here in Louisville, who are down there fishing on the Ohio River every day. And they are fishing to supplement their family's diet. And we can't lose sight of those people either.
And exposure to these toxins like mercury has been associated with nervous system issues and problems with developing fetuses, even cancer. But if you don't eat fish from the river, a lot of fish, why should we care about these toxins in the river?
First of all, there is commercial fishing in the Ohio. There can be fish sticks at your local food store that you may not know that came from Ohio River fish. So that's one reason we should care about them. But we should care about them for a whole lot of different reasons. We should care about them for all the other wildlife that are going to eat those fish. Raccoons, you get the eagles that we see coming back throughout the Ohio River Basin. One of the reasons some of those pollutants were originally banned was because we saw the devastating consequences that they had on the reproductive viability of the eagle and the osprey and the hawk eggs.
You know, on the Hudson River in New York, there was a major issue with PCBs, and it was addressed by dredging that portion of the river. Is the Ohio sort of to that level of pollution, or is it more like a sleeping giant? We don't want to disturb what's there by dredging it up.
That's a very extreme case, and it's a very large river to try to be dredging. Once you start dredging the river, you stir up all those contaminated sediments, and they can remix with the water. And so in most cases, it just makes sense to let nature take its course. I think the PCBs and the dioxins are a little different than the mercury. We're not really discharging PCBs and dioxins. Those are legacy contaminants. Mercury is also a bit of a legacy contaminant, but it's the kind of pollution that actually my organization has been actively engaged in fighting. What we're worried about are new and continued discharges of mercury into the river when parts of the river are already contaminated for mercury in terms of fish consumption. And we're worried that if we tip that scale even further, the entire river will be contaminated. So we'll be hopefully flushing out and cleaning up the dioxin and the PCBs that are the legacy contaminants. But if we add mercury, then we've done a very much disservice for, you know, not just even fish consumption, but possibly for some of the smaller drinking water systems that rely on the Ohio River. Mercury is not an easy thing to get out. If you live here in Louisville or you live in Pittsburgh, you live in one of these major cities, they have sophisticated water treatment. But if you live in a smaller town and there becomes too much mercury in the river, it's going to escalate their treatment costs enormously. And they may or may not be able to afford to treat for mercury in the river. So it's one of the reasons why we are actively fighting new discharges of mercury into the river.
Not even reduced discharges, but no discharges at all.
Right. So a number of years ago, Orsenco passed a...
They're the agency that's responsible for water quality in the basin.
Yes. It's a 8-state agency. Orsenco, 10 years out, they said, okay, in 2013, there will be no more discharges of mercury above a certain level into the Ohio River. And they gave industries 10 years to comply with that. Well, come 2013, they found that they weren't ready to comply. They have indefinitely extended that variance, that waiver, if you will, and they have given that responsibility back to the individual states. Well, as a headwater state, what that means for Pennsylvania is, you know, maybe not the same thing as it means for a downstream state like us here in Kentucky.
You are receiving what's coming downstream from other places.
Yep. We all live downstream, whether it's a, you know, a little bitty stream that feeds into a larger stream that feeds into the Ohio River. But if you're a major river city like Louisville, well, you live downstream from Pittsburgh and Wheeling and Cincinnati and all the other big and little towns that are upstream of both the Ohio as well as the Allegheny and the Monongahela.
How does all this, you know, legacy pollution and new pollution impact the Ohio River Basin's future, like economically with recreation and fishing and also health?
I don't want to get so far into the pollution scenario that we lose sight of the fact that the Ohio River is cleaner than it's been in many, many decades. People cleaning up all the sewer overflows, the Clean Water Act that put limits on many of these kind of industrial facilities that discharge into the Ohio, all of those have had an enormous impact. I just want to make sure that we don't start sliding backwards or start losing momentum because the job is not done.
It's still nationally ranked as one of the most polluted rivers, or the most polluted river.
It does have that ranking as the most polluted river, and that is based on data in a particular index called the Toxic Release Inventory. But believe it or not, there is one facility in Indiana that discharges a lot of nitrates that puts the Ohio over and above all those other rivers. There are things we can do to clean it up. And I think that people need to say that this is one of the basic government functions that we are willing to fund. This is a government service that we all need.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
You're very welcome.
Judy Peterson is Executive Director of Kentucky Waterways Alliance. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. News about lead in drinking water over the past year might have given some people pause about drinking from the tap. Those who get their water from the Ohio River headwaters, like in Pittsburgh and most of West Virginia, have also heard about chemical and oil spills over the years. But that doesn't necessarily mean their drinking water is more polluted. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Ann Lee reports all the problems might actually be helping make drinking water safe.
So you wake up every morning, and chances are one of the first things you do is turn on the faucet. More than 3 million people in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and West Virginia get that tap water from the Ohio River. And according to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Ohio is also one of the most polluted rivers in the country. Remember hearing newscasts like this one a few years ago?
This morning, more than 300,000 West Virginians are scrambling for water after a toxic chemical spill contaminated the main water supply in 9 counties across Charleston.
So here's what happened. In 2014, 10,000 gallons of a coal processing chemical leaked into the Elk River from a storage tank owned by Freedom Industries. And it was just upstream from a water treatment plant, where Charleston pulls in water from the river to send to its customers.
Right now, so many people scrambling for water after residents were warned away from using tap water for anything.
Evan Hansen is head of an environmental consulting group in Morgantown, West Virginia. And when he saw what was happening, he got to work.
I started just doing some online research into source water protection and some of the policies that were related to that, and just started tweeting out some information that I started to find.
He gathered enough information to write a report about it, and West Virginia lawmakers quickly noticed.
The impact was so great because the drinking water system got contaminated. So systems were not in place or actions were not taken to prevent that contamination from happening.
So this spill, which is in a part of West Virginia known as Chemical Valley, got the whole state to get serious about protecting its drinking water supply from chemical spills. West Virginia increased regulation of chemical storage tanks, and it required water treatment plants to spell out how they would protect their source water. That's the water we drink and use in our homes. Other states along the Ohio River, like Pennsylvania and Ohio, have been taking these kinds of steps for years.
The Ohio River has been in front of any water system in this country and probably around the world.
That's Stanley States. He worked at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for more than 30 years. He now educates experts at water treatment plants around the country on how to protect drinking water from chemical spills and other environmental problems. And when he says the river in states like Pennsylvania is better regulated, it's not necessarily because they had so much foresight. Nope, it was because they had spills of their own.
Because you have to justify the expense. Unfortunately, they have to wait usually for definitive proof that this is really a threat before you can justify putting huge sums of money in.
Another benefit of unexpected contamination in the river, if you can even call it that, is improved water monitoring. Richard Harrison is the head of the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, called ORSANCO. They get about 600 calls a year about spills into the river.
Some are a cup of material.
But when it's a bigger spill, ORSANCO works with the water utilities to assess what should be done.
And really help determine if it's something that the downstream utilities need to be concerned about.
So as the Elk River spill made its way down to the Ohio River, water utilities were in communication. By the time the contamination reached Cincinnati, they already knew what time to expect it and how long to shut down their water intakes.
And then we were able to work with the Greater Cincinnati Water Works to then convey that same information downstream to Louisville and Evansville.
Now, you might also expect that treatment plants continuously test the raw water coming into their plants. And they do in some cities like Pittsburgh. Charleston was required to do it after the Elk River spill. But that's actually a new idea in many places. Some treatment plants just don't have the resources for that kind of technology. That's where new technology can help. We're in Highland Park in Pittsburgh. today sparkles with blue skies, crisp air, and ducks flying over a small pond. At age 26, Christopher Tomaszewski looks a little old to be playing with a toy boat. He's holding a computer tablet and controlling a meter-long boat in the water. He's actually a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University.
And I work at Platypus, which is an environmental monitoring company. We use robots like this to survey areas for depth or pollution.
It's kind of like a drone in the water. It uses a cell phone's compass and GPS systems to navigate around. Platypus has been used to collect water quality data near wastewater treatment plants for information about salinity and dissolved oxygen,
which is critical for like plant life and fish.
He says the data and water samples collected by this little boat can get a more comprehensive look at what's happening in the water than researchers could ever get before. And that's just one way technology is being used. As inexpensive projects like Platypus improve data gathering, others are now sharing that information online and in real time. The idea is to keep giving water treatment plants more information and more notice so they can handle what's coming down the river and protect their sources of drinking water. Reporting for the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Lee with West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
That story is part of the Headwaters series, where, in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting, we're taking a closer look at the vast water resources of the Ohio River. Next week, it's the world's oldest renewable energy source, but experts say there's still a lot of this untapped energy in our rivers.
If you look out and you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam, that basically is unused energy.
More about plans to harness hydropower in Pittsburgh's Three Rivers. That's as our Headwaters series continues. Until then, there's more over at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Crows are surprisingly like people, smart, social. And while the kids like to hang out with their friends,
the older birds tend to stay at home and don't go down to the roost.
I feel them. Later on the Allegheny Front, we get a little insight into the lives of these late fall visitors in many cities. Is that crow laughing at me? Stay tuned. Since April, the Standing Rock Sioux and thousands of Native American supporters and other activists have been camped out on tribal land in North Dakota. They're protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. The pipeline will carry fracked oil from the Bakken in North Dakota to Illinois. The protesters say the route, tunneling under a lake, will jeopardize clean water for the tribe and others, and that construction has already desecrated burial sites and other sacred land. The Obama administration put a hold on the final permit to build this section of the pipeline until there's more information about its impacts. But the Army Corps has ordered the protesters, called the Water Protectors, to leave the camp by December 5th. Harsh winter conditions and reports of intimidation by authorities, including the use of water cannons and a blockade of supplies, have prompted military veterans from across the country to head to Standing Rock this weekend to stand with the protesters. Helen Gearhart is a veteran and grassroots organizer from Pittsburgh. She's packing up her car and driving the almost 1,400 miles to lend her support to the protesters. I got a chance to sit down and talk with Gearhart before she left. So what kinds of things are you bringing with you?
Everything from sub-zero sleeping bags to face masks, gas masks, full body suits, insulated body suits. As the weather gets more extreme, that kind of stuff will really mean the difference between survival and or being able to really stick it out over time, which a lot of the people who are there feel that it's going to be a long fight.
So how did this trip come about? Why did you decide to go?
Well, I had been sharing the news about this veterans action on Facebook, by social media, and it felt like it was time to put my own body in alignment with my beliefs. You know, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. I delivered supplies to military camps all across Iraq. And many times our convoys would be following all these oil extraction convoys. They were extracting the wealth, the oil wealth of Iraq. There were so many private companies that were sending private security, making profits off the country in numerous ways. And so it feels very fitting that I would now deliver supplies to a camp that is resisting the continuance of a whole system, energy system, that's wrecking our planet. You know, through this whole garbage fire of an election, climate change was barely talked about. And it is the crisis of our time. We're facing massive displacements, massive poverty, famine, drought. You know, we see the kind of ecological devastation that's happening in our own country. And the water protectors are bringing the attention of the entire world to that crisis. And so I want to do everything I can to help support them.
So many veterans across the country are heading to Standing Rock this weekend for a few days action, and their intent is to provide some sort of protection for the protesters there. So what will you do when you arrive in Standing Rock?
I am going to talk with people who I know well, good friends whose judgment I trust. I want to talk with the indigenous leaders, with the water protectors themselves. I want to be fully assured by them that this action is in accord with their own concerns, tactics, strategies. And if so, then I will take part with the veterans action. If not, I will try to observe, witness, write, and record stories from it. So I will be there. I just want to make sure that there is real respect for the careful planning and thoughtful training in civil disobedience that has characterized the actions of the water protectors at Standing Rock.
The police presence at the camp has been referred to as militarized. Water cannons and dogs have been used on protesters there. And I'm wondering, as a veteran, if that has special significance for you.
Absolutely. When I was in the National Guard, we were actually trained in crowd control methods. And over the past years, the restrictions and the safeguards on such use of force have really gone down. Our various military forces, our police forces, and private security forces have become increasingly brutal in their use of force.
Are you afraid for your safety?
Oh, yeah. I'm afraid. But it's a different kind of fear than I felt in Iraq. The time I was most afraid is when the news about Abu Ghraib hit the airwaves. I was there in 2004.
Abu Ghraib, that's the prison where there was shown to be torture of prisoners there.
Yeah. And up until then, I really had not felt much fear. But when I drove out of the camp that day, nobody would even look at us. And the kids that used to run toward the truck for candy or for food that we would throw out the windows would not even look at us. And so that's such a different kind of fear than putting yourself on the line for causes that you care about when you're trying to be responsible to your communities and to the larger global community that we're a part of.
Are there connections for you between the conflict at Standing Rock and issues around pipelines and safety here in Pennsylvania?
I've been very impressed by the ways that the water protectors have highlighted just how many spills there have been, how they have polluted waterways that affect enormous watersheds. The water protectors are saying this is not just simply about protecting our rights over our indigenous lands, where there's a treaty, this is actually our land. They're saying this water goes out into so many different communities, and we're standing up for them as well. And so I think that I do want to do a better job of lifting up exactly what's happening here in Pennsylvania and showing those connections.
Do you think of yourself as an environmental activist?
I guess now I do. I've done quite a bit of talking about environmental justice in terms of how low-income communities are most affected by environmental crises. My work, my jobs, my various volunteers have not been really explicitly focused on environmental activism. I'm going to have to become much more of an environmental activist over the next years as we witness what climate change is doing to our communities.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Kara.
Helen Gearhart is a veteran. She served with the Missouri Army National Guard in the Iraq War and an activist in Pittsburgh. There's more about the Standing Rock Sioux and the Dakota Access Pipeline at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. They're back. If you live in an urban area, you might have noticed large groups or murders of crows congregating in raucous roosts. Penn State University's Margaret Brittingham fills us in on this phenomenon.
Crows are known for their intelligence. Just ask anybody who's tried to get crows to move away from their roosting sites. The large flocks of crows in our region now are primarily migrants that are here to spend the winter. The number of roosting crows tends to build up steadily through November and December. These large winter roosts were historically in rural areas, but over time, as crows adapted to people, they moved their winter roosts into urban areas. Here, they benefit from the warmth of the city. They are attracted to well-lit areas, which may enhance their ability to detect approaching predators. Their roosts can number up to hundreds of thousands of birds. Roosts are most common in medium-sized cities with easy access to rural lands. The crows roost in the city during the night, then at dawn they scatter, often flying more than 10 miles to feed in fields and neighborhoods. In mid-afternoon, the birds gather in pre-roosting groups. As the day progresses, flocks band together, forming larger and larger flocks. Just before dusk, the assembled group disperses. The flocks form lines across the sky. Crows call as they fly into the roost, perhaps encouraging their compatriots to join them. As dark settles, they crowd together. They roost in dense clusters and trees on urban streets and parks. These migrant crows, winter visitors to the area, are occasionally joined by some of the townies. These are the resident crows. They include the crows that might have nested in local backyards over the summer. Research has shown that the locals who join the roost tend to be the teenagers. They are birds that may have helped mom and dad raise young, but don't have their own territory. The older birds tend to stay at home and don't go down to the roost. Crow roosts are considered traditional, meaning they occur in the same area year after year. Younger birds learn roost locations from older members of the flock. In late February, early March, the roost breaks up as crows depart and migrate north for breeding. So next time you see lines of crows darkening our skies at night, take a minute to marvel in the wonder of these smart, social birds. For the Allegheny Front Bird Files, I'm Margaret Brittingham.
Bird sounds for that segment are courtesy of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. As Margaret said, these birds are smart, even smart enough to recognize and differentiate between human faces. Researchers found this out by using a Dick Cheney mask. You kind of have to see it to believe it. There's a video at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.